Hello, friends, and this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place, and I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better place. I want to thank everyone so much for making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest-growing metaphysical and spiritual radio program in the world with over 150,000 listeners in over 70 countries. We have an incredible show for you today. We're very fortunate to have Brian Forster coming to us live from South America. He's actually in Paracas, Peru, a place where I was a couple of weeks ago. Paracas is a beautiful place, and Brian is an expert in ancient Inca culture and the megalithic works of South America and the ancient elongated-headed people of Peru. His website for more information is www.hiddenincatours.com, and his interview should be really out of this world. He's on the line now, and I'll make some announcements, and then we'll bring him on. I just returned from Peru myself last week, and during the second hour, I'll be talking about my trip and all the places I saw. So please stay tuned for that. It's an amazing place and one you should go to if you have the chance. I also would like to mention some upcoming events on Saturday, October 28th, tomorrow from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. I'll be giving a free presentation on my book and the messages from great masters at the Crystal Voyage Bookstore and Spiritual Center in Tacoma, Washington, at the corner of Cedar Street and 38th Avenue West near the Tacoma Mall. I'll be giving messages from President John F. Kennedy, Nostradamus, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Dr. Masaru Emoto, Mahatma Gandhi, and a host of other great spirits. So I hope you can come. Proceeds from the presentation, any donations will go to the Emoto Peace Project, and I hope you can come. I'll also have copies of my newly published book called Messages from the Masters available for those who'd like to come. This week, from October 26th to the 29th, there's a wonderful water conference in Sofia, Bulgaria, with some of the world's most fascinating water scientists. For more information about this wonderful conference, please see their website at www.waterconference.org. One of the speakers of the conference will be my good friend, Professor Jerry Pollack at the University of Washington. He's one of the world's most famous water scientists, and his laboratory relies solely on donations for support. If you'd like to send a donation to help support Professor Pollack, please email him at ghp@u.washington.edu. I want to thank everyone so much for their support for this radio program, because Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support, because I know together we can and will create a much better and happier world. And with that, I'd like to thank Jan Rossini of California for her wonderful contribution recently, as well as a lot of other people who supported me recently, especially Anita Curtis in Dublin, Ireland, and Bill Bacon out of Seattle. They really helped me out recently with their donations. And also like to thank the sponsors of this show, including the Crystal Voyage Bookstore in Tacoma and the wonderful Orion Tech Computers of Bend, Oregon. We're looking for sponsors and advertisers for the show, and any advertising on the program will have a worldwide audience for your goods and services. With that, I'd like to thank my dear friend Carol's behind my website, providing wonderful support, my friends in the Galactic Alliance who've been supporting my show, my angelic and earthly family, and, of course, Eric and and the wonderful crew here at KKNW, without whose help and support this program would not be possible. I also have a spiritual mentoring program where I teach people how to contact their angels and spirit guides. And if you'd like to get in touch with your loved ones and passed on or contact your guides, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, or you can call me in the United States here at 509-750-9793, or toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-888-879-8339. But just before we start our show today, I'd like to ask everyone to send lots of love and light to Florida, the people of Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, the Virgin Islands, as well as to Mexico, because they've suffered recently in that recent earthquake, and I know that your love and light will help. Also, I'd like to ask everyone to send lots of love and light to my good friend Carolyn White in Olympia, who's been in and out of the hospital recently. I know your prayers will really help her. Also, if you could send a love and light to Michiko Hayashi's mother, Misako, in Japan, who had a stroke earlier this year, as well as my good friend Orion in Bend, Oregon, who was diagnosed with throat cancer, and he's recuperating now, and Dr. William Mount in Tacoma. Thank you so much for all your prayers and for sending them a love and light. I know it's had a really beneficial effect for them. Also, I want to thank everyone so much for their support for my recent Galactic Wisdom Conference that was held in Olympia, Washington, here in the United States earlier this year. Because of its success, I'll be having my fourth annual conference on March 9th, 10th, and 11th in Olympia, Washington at 9101 Stillicum Road in Olympia, Washington, about an hour south of the Seattle airport. For more information, you can see our website at www.galacticwisdomconference.com. If you register early for the conference before the end of December, the registration fee is only $147 for the entire weekend, 3 days, or after January 1st, the cost will be $197. Our speakers for the next year's conference will be Michiko Hayashi, the Moto Peace Project in Tokyo, Japan, and the famous Dr. Yoshi, who will be demonstrating the awesome Hado vibrational machines. In addition, we'll be having a famous naturopathic doctor, Dr. Kyra Roca from the Bahamas, who will be giving presentations on ancient Buddhist healing techniques, homeopathy, and a host of other healing methods. Also, we'll be having Dr. Angel Fernandez of the Dominican Republic, who will be talking about Telos and the New Earth. Simon Parks will also be giving a presentation. I've also planned to invite Paul Hellier to come. I also will be giving a presentation on messages from Professor Einstein, President Kennedy, and his brother, Senator Kennedy, as well as Mahatma Gandhi, Nikolai Tesla, Nostradamus, and the Galactic Alliance, and Dr. Moto. So the conference should be really out of this world. I hope you can all come. With that, I'd like to introduce my first guest, Brian Forrester, who was born in Rochester, Minnesota, but he's coming to us live today from a beautiful place called Paracas on the Pacific Ocean of Peru in South America. Brian, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ted.
You sound like you're right in the next door room. Actually, it's the reception's perfect.
Great.
Well, Brian, I have to tell you, I read a bit about you on the internet, and I contacted you when I was in Paracas looking at the Elongated Skulls Museum. You're a fascinating fellow. How did you ever end up in South America doing what you do now?
Well, I've always had a fascination since childhood of ancient places and mystic things and the paranormal and UFOs and all that kind of thing. And from an early age, I began exploring, going to England when I was 16 with a friend of mine without any parental supervision.
Uh-huh.
And over the course of time, I've explored about 90 countries. I was actually a professional totem pole carver on the west coast of Canada for a while.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And then explored through Polynesia for a number of years. And then one morning, a little voice in my head said Peru four times, and I thought, oh, I haven't been to Peru. Maybe I should have a look. And that was about 14 years ago.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. Now, if you could tell, I've been to the museum at Paracas, but if you could tell all my listeners about the museum there, it's a fascinating place. And one of the things that I realized looking at those skulls, Brian, is that a lot of the skulls in that museum at Paracas, they don't have any sutures on the skull. It's just a smooth, because most humans, when we're born on this planet and we come out of our mother's womb, we have these lines in our skulls allowing the skull to collapse when we come out of the womb. But these are a lot of the skulls there, I've noticed when I was there a couple weeks ago, are smooth, indicating that perhaps they were hatched and out of eggs and not fully human. I'd love your take on that, by the way.
Sure. Well, I met Senior Juan Navarro about 9 years ago in Paracas. He was running a little private museum of about 250 pieces from five cultures that he found in the area. And there was a mummified elongated head, which obviously drew my attention. He then said, well, I have more at home. And I said, well, could you please bring them tomorrow so I could look at them? And that's what began my fascination. I started to look up on the internet for academic studies of these people, and there was basically very little mention of why they had elongated heads. And so I found that very odd. Uh-huh. And coming from a scientific background, I decided to take on the project of trying to figure out who these ancient people were.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. There's another Indian settlement about 20, if I'm not mistaken, 2,500 years old, south of the Nazca lines, which I also visited a couple weeks ago, Brian. And down there, too, there's a lot of mummies. And those mummies also, they don't have the elongated heads, but they have huge, huge heads, much bigger than most people on this planet nowadays have. And you can see that influence in their skulls, too.
Oh, which culture was that?
I believe it's the, let me look here. I've got it. Chowchilla? The Chowchilla Indians, it's about 2 hours south of Nazca. I hired a car when I was there a couple weeks ago and went out there, just curious. People told me about it.
Oh, yeah, that's the Chowchilla Cemetery.
Chowchilla Cemetery, right. And
right.
One of the things, too, I'm sensitive to this because I'm a psychic. When I photographed one of the mummies out there, I could see there was a spirit hanging around, and that was from one of the mummies, actually. So they're very much around, and they knew I was there checking them out. I was friendly. I mean, I thanked them for coming here, for letting me see them. But you see those heads too down there. They're very large. Some of them are very, very large. And you tie that in with the Nazca lines, and I personally think, and I'd love your opinion on this too, Brian, the Nazca lines were actually markers for extraterrestrial craft coming into this planet, if you will. There's even an astronaut there painted on the side of a mountain, of course, in the Nazca lines. But you tie that in with the elongated skulls at Paracas, where you are now, and it's obvious that there was, to me anyway, that there was some hybridization between humans and whatever race that came in to visit us way back when.
Well, actually, I wrote a book about the Nazca Lines. I've got 25 books now.
Fantastic.
And I studied all of the different theories about Nazca, and there isn't one single one that answers all the questions. So it's mm-hmm. it's really a question of time. The lines were begun, and the geoglyphs, about 500 BC by the Paracas culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 100 AD, I believe that there was a genocide of the Paracas by the Nazca. The Nazca took over the area, and they continued line and geoglyph building up until about 600 AD, when they had to abandon the area due to massive drought. So some of the lines were made for solstices markers, others were for lunar cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the figures were made for ceremonial purposes. Even archaeologists will admit that the astronaut was made by the Paracas culture because its execution is quite different. One other thing that people don't know is that in between Paracas and Nazca is a location called Paupa, and the Nazca area has about 30 to 40 major animal geoglyphs, including the astronaut. But in Paupa, there are more than 1,000 smaller ones. And most of those were done by the Paracas culture.
Oh, fascinating. So the skulls that are there at Paracas now, are they themselves from the Paracas culture, or are they older than the Paracas culture, you think?
Yeah, they are from the Paracas culture. The interesting thing is that cranial deformation, or changing the shape of the human head, did not continue into the Nazca culture. The Nazca were just normal-looking people, so that's why I suspect that there was genocide. And the elongated skulls were only those of the royal elite members of the Paracas society. Other anomalies are that they all seem to have had dark red hair, which is not Native American. The Nazca were black-haired people, but the Paracas were red-headed, and they also seemed to average about 6 feet tall, which is extremely tall for ancient Native Peruvian people.
Right. I have to ask you this question, Brian, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to jump all over the place, but an Easter Island, I haven't been to Easter Island, but I've heard that the tall statues, which are in stone there, represented another extraterrestrial race which visited that island, and I can't remember somebody telling me that they also had red hair. I don't know whether you know much about that, but it's interesting to tie these strings together, because I think they do fit.
Well, funnily enough, I wrote a book about Easter Island as well.
Oh, excellent.
Because I visited there twice. I've had a fascination since I was a little kid. It's a very small place, but when you read the documentation, especially the account of the crew of Roggeveen, who was the first European to go there, and he's the one who named it Easter Island because he landed on Easter Sunday. The account was that there were dark-skinned people, light-skinned people, tall people, short people, black-haired people, red-haired people, and blonde-haired people.
Wow.
And if you look at the actual Moai figures, which most people associate with the head sticking out of the ground, each one of those figures is a full body. So most of the most of the body is still buried underground. And so there are two different styles. There's the Polynesian style, which is of a sort of flattish nose and slightly cruder in execution. And then you have the bigger figures, which have an aquiline or European-looking nose. And those, I believe, were made by a civilization thousands of years before the Polynesians ever got there. And that would also account for the blonde and red hair.
Wow, that's just amazing. That is just amazing. There's so much history that we don't know anything, know much about, so we have to kind of speculate. Do you know, in the Paracas culture, jumping back to where you are now, Brian, did they leave any kind of written records at all, or was it oral traditions among the people there that you know of?
It was oral tradition, and the Paracas died out 2,000 years ago, leaving basically no descendants, except it is possible that some of the royalty were able to escape on a road, an Inca slash much older road that goes from Paracas all the way to Cusco in the highlands of Peru, because early accounts of the Inca by the Spanish conquistadors was that they had elongated heads and they had red hair. So I think that must have come from the Paracas. Also, the Inca had a secret language called Capac Simi, which means the high language. And that's also believed to be the language of the Paracas, which is called Puquina. And that language is quite different from the Inca standard language that most people know of as Quechua.
Right. I met three shaman actually in Cusco, who all spoke Quechua. Is that right? Quechua or Quechua? And one of them, Brian, did not speak any Spanish or English. Only Quechua. That's the only thing he spoke in his village, which I thought was interesting. His son would translate for him.
Yeah, he is probably a Caro. And that's a tribal group that live on, I think, at about 20,000 feet altitude on a mountain called Ausangate, which is one of the Andes. And they, as soon as the conquistadors were trashing Cusco in 1533, people like that, the spiritual people who survived, escaped and climbed this high mountain in order to get away from the Spanish. And they have been quite successful in retaining what is left of the Inca knowledge for about 500 years.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. He's a wonderful man. I met the shaman there, and he gave a healing ceremony on me. I asked him to, and I feel pretty good after that. It was a spiritual healing ceremony, and it was funny because I asked him, his son, whether the central government in Peru helps them. He says, not much. No, they leave us alone. And he smiled. He said, we want it that way. So anyway.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. The Peruvian government, at least in modern times, doesn't interfere too much with the native cultures, which is great because that helps them retain who they are. Mm-hmm. And too much government intervention has a tendency of destroying things. So we're very fortunate that the Caro and other native groups in Peru are at least somewhat autonomous.
Right. And that's really good. You know, in your book, which is available online, this is a brief history of the Incas, you wrote something very interesting. You quoted a Spanish explorer who knew of the Incas there and the Native Americans, and he made some interesting observations. Let me look for it here. I'm sure you remember the quote. He talked about how. Here we go. Yeah, I want to read this real quick. You were quote in 1589, Don Mancino Serra de Legazpi. I hope I pronounced that correctly. The last survival of the original conquerors of Peru wrote of the Inca. Quote, we found these Inca kingdoms in such good order upon our arrival, and the Incas governed them in such a wise manner that throughout them there wasn't a thief, nor a vicious man, nor an adulteress, nor a bad woman, nor a bad man. These were not immoral people. The men had honest and useful occupations. The lands, forests, mines, pastures, houses, and all kinds of products were regulated and distributed in such a way that each person knew his property without another person seeing or occupying it. And then he writes, for we, the Spanish, have destroyed by our evil example the people who had such a government as was enjoyed by these natives. They were so free from the committal of crimes or excesses, as well as men and women, that the Indian who had 100,000 pesos worth of gold or silver in his house left it open by merely placing a small stick against the door as a sign that his master was out. With that, according to their custom, no one could enter or take anything that was there. When they saw that we put locks and keys on our doors, they supposed it was from the fear of them, that they might not kill us, but not because they believed anyone would steal the property of another. So when they found that we had thieves among us, and the men who sought to make their daughters commit sin, they despised us. And I thought that was a fascinating quote that you put in your book.
Yeah, it's the Inca were an incredibly honest society, and that partially led to their downfall because the Spanish conquistadors used deceit and lying to their advantage in order to take over. And the Inca were, I wouldn't use the term innocent, it's just they had a code of ethics that they lived by. And the funny thing is with that thing about the stick is that even to this day, if you go to some of the stores in Cusco, that's what they still do. They if they're going out for lunch, they don't lock the door. They'll simply put a stick across it. Wow. And expect people to not cross over the threshold.
That is so beautiful. You know, maybe the United States government should, and Congress, our Congress here in the United States, should bring some of the Inca shaman and spiritual people here to the United States, because I think our politicians especially could learn from them in terms of ethics and telling the truth to people.
Well, not to mention needing major psychological healing of some kind.
Well, that's where the shaman would come in.
But, exactly.
But I was just amazed upon that quote because I've always felt that Native American peoples were very close to the land, and it made me feel really good to read that statement because the people, the indigenous peoples I met in Peru were all very loving and their heart opened up to you. I mean, I just really enjoyed that part of the visit down there, and I think that one of my friends, I have a lot of psychic friends being a psychic myself, and she said that the Inca were actually a fourth dimensional civilization. We're in the third here, but they were a fourth and fifth dimensional civilization. And that's why they were with their enemies. For example, when they did conquer other peoples in the Peru area and neighboring areas, but what they did, they conquered a people, Brian. The Spanish wrote that they didn't kill them all off. Instead, they gave them presents and enticements, and argued with them in a humane way to bring them into their civilization. That's how they expanded their empire, not through violence so much as gentle persuasion.
No, that's an excellent point, and that's where again most academics have the history of the Inca wrong, because they're basing their knowledge on Spanish accounts, and the Spanish accounts were rarely honest. The Inca, being overtaken by the Spanish, had a tendency not to pass on their true knowledge because they were being attacked and oppressed. And so you really have to go to the oral traditions and local people to find out what the true history was. And the Inca had three basic principles: be loving, be honest, and work hard. Those were the three laws. And when they would advance, the term empire is incorrect because that's a European term. It was actually the Inca Confederation of States, with Cusco being the capital. And so what they would do is they would send emissaries, either north or south, to talk to the chiefs of the next civilization, and they would try to entice them into joining by offering the benefits of being part of the Inca civilization, including advanced agriculture, metallurgy, etc. And they would do this three times, and on the third time, if the civilization decided not to join, that's when they were told that the army was going to come and conquer.
Wow.
And so they were given, you know, they were given three times, and the fourth time is like, okay, here we go.
Wow.
And so the Inca army would enter, and they would battle the opposition. As soon as the opposition would drop their weapons, then automatically they were part of the civilization, but they were still allowed to keep their language, their costumes, their spirituality, and other aspects of their culture. It's just that the Inca insisted that the sun be the symbol of the highest level of deity, and that everyone had to learn the Inca language because they didn't want to have translators all over the place.
Right.
So the people were allowed to keep their language. It's just all official business and administration and government had to be in the Inca language.
One thing you write in your book, and I want to mention this too, it's a fascinating book. I urge everyone to read it. The ethics, the daily life of Inca people revolved again around three basic principles or laws: be truthful, be honest, and work hard. And you write, this is later corrupted by the Spanish as, quote, don't lie, don't cheat, and don't be lazy. In other words, they converted, you write, to three positive principles with three that had negative connotations, which was unfortunate because I think you can get people a lot further when you say it in a positive way rather than in a negative way.
Most definitely, and that was the major Inca philosophy, was everything being positive. They did believe in duality, not necessarily good and evil, but they understood that there was, you know, black and white, etc. But they tried to emphasize those three principles in an honest way, and that caused people to be very productive. If you say work hard, that's a motivational tool, as in don't be lazy or be loving,
right?
Etc. And that's why they were so successful in expansion. And when the Spanish arrived, the people under the care of the royal Inca family, because the general population were not Inca, it was a royal family, and they were the high Inca was the caretaker. He was not the king of the people. He was the caretaker of the people. Their population was more than 15 million.
My goodness. Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, you know, it's interesting, and since that time, the Spanish are still in control in a way, aren't they, through the government? Is it still mostly Spanish-based as far as the main government goes in Peru?
Well, it's a mix. The present president is of, I think, Polish background, but the previous one has an Inca name. So I think there have been two or three presidents who are native. Quite a few of the people in the assembly are of either native or mixed blood. But from what I've heard, something like 30 European-based families control most of the economy. So there still is oppression to some degree, or you could say a glass ceiling in terms of what the individual can achieve in society.
Well, the positive aspects of Inca culture, I think, will become actually more important in the coming years because people, I think we have a very bright and beautiful future, Brian, from my own perspective. And I think that the entire planet is actually turning into a much more harmonious and loving place than it has been in the past. And the kind of violence that we've had and all the wars that we've had in recent centuries, that is going to become a thing of the past as well. So these principles, these positive principles of Inca life, I think will become important not only for Peru, but also for the rest of the world as well. And I think many countries, including the United States, could learn from the ancient Inca in terms of their spiritual lessons and how to evolve into a more beautiful and harmonious society.
Yeah, I agree very much. And it's there are many other native cultures, too, that retain these beautiful, positive ancient principles, which we could all learn from. I've been a student of native culture since I was about 7 years old. And I've just been fortunate in that now it's, I wouldn't say native people are my profession. It's just I know a lot of people in Peru and other parts of the world who teach me on a constant basis about the positive aspects of how to live, an honest and truly human life.
Right, right. One of the things I really like being in Peru, and this goes for much of South America and Latin America, and I think it's because of the native influence there, is that people often, Brian, seem to think with their heart rather than their logical mind. Of course, that's different up here in North America because so many people here flip-flop it. They instead think in their logical mind. But the reason I'm saying that is because since 2015 or 16 or 15, actually, I've been in touch with the people of the Hollow Earth beneath Mount Shasta. And they said it's very important in our own spiritual evolution to try to think, always think with our heart mind. Which is 2,000 times, they said the heart itself is 2,000 times much stronger than our logical brain. So whenever you make a decision, meditate and always trust your intuition to going through the heart mind for answers on how you should lead your life and make decisions. I've always remembered that, and it really resonated with me when I was down in Peru recently because so many people think with their heart mind, and I think that's from the native influence and not necessarily with their logical mind.
Well, that's very true, and the bulk of the Peruvian population are native people, and they have a tendency of obviously not being wealthy, but most people that I know are quite content with their lives. If they want to do better in terms of finances or whatever, they do have that opportunity if they want to think in an entrepreneurial way, but most people I know are obviously they make enough money to be able to feed and clothe themselves and their family and feed them and educate them, etc. Right. And they don't have the aspiration, I don't think, that North Americans and Europeans have of individuality and I'm what's important and I want to get ahead and I need more and more and more, like in an excessive kind of way.
Right. Yeah, it's a different kind of mindset. I have to tell you, too, when I travel, Brian, I'm often try to be very sensitive to the vibrations I pick up. And when I flew into Lima, I could feel the vibrations go up. But then when I flew from Lima to Cusco up in the Andean Mountains, as soon as I got off the plane, I could feel the vibrations go way up. And I have a feeling it's from the Inca, because that was the center of Inca culture, wasn't it? Back at their heyday?
Yeah, and actually I have the same feeling. We have an apartment in Cusco, so I've flown into Cusco at least 100 times, and every time we approach Cusco, my heart rises, I feel again connected with I believe, my Inca guides in Cusco. I think they very much welcomed me ever since I got there, because I have a hunger to share positive ancient information with whoever wants to listen, and that's why I've been allowed to, to spend so much time in Cusco and learn so much. Cusco was defeated physically by the Spanish, but they could never conquer the heart, they could never conquer the land, could never conquer the history. And there still is, most people who are actually, if you walk the streets of Cusco, you can see in the faces of people if they have the Inca ancestry, because they tend to be reasonably tall, very angular, beautiful features. Mm-hmm. So there still is quite a high Inca blood quantum existing in Cusco. And what the main flag you see flying in Cusco is that of the Inca. The Peruvian flag is secondary.
Interesting. Wow. That's,
that's power.
That's really interesting. Now, it mentioned in your book that the Plaza de Armas, which is the main central one of the main central squares in Cusco, was actually a center for the Incas. And when I was down there a couple of weeks ago, I'd love your comments on this. It looks like I read about this, that the Spanish dismantled many of the Inca monuments and made churches out of the rocks and stones. Although you can still see walls constructed by the Incas in the area.
Yeah, that's the most interesting thing about Cusco is it appears that the Inca arrived about 1,000 years ago, and they found an abandoned megalithic city. Mm-hmm. The really tight-fitting joinery stonework was not done by the Inca. It was done by an advanced civilization of some kind, because the Inca at best had bronze tools, and the stone they were working with is like granite, much harder. So that's my theory, is that the Inca returned to this ancient place when they were chased out of the Lake Titicaca area, and they returned to Cusco, which simply means the navel or the center of the world.
Have you been to Lake Titicaca, by the way, and what's that like? That's one place I didn't make it to. I'd love your impressions of it.
I've probably been there at least 50 times.
Okay, great.
I was actually there about 4 days ago. It's the highest navigable lake in the world. It's about 120 miles long and about 60 miles wide. The weather can get it's like a sea. The weather can get incredibly tough there, but it does have a number of amazing ancient monuments on both sides of the lake, and it's one of the hotbeds of UFO activity. I've met many people who live in the area that say that discs fly into and out of the lake on a regular basis, especially at night.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. My friends in the Hollow Earth said there's entrances there to the Hollow Earth, and actually they're all through that mountain chain, but that's one of the reasons why you see the craft going in and out a lot. I take tours down to Mount Shasta, and we always, at night, Brian, we always see the UFOs flying in and out of Mount Shasta. And I suspect they tell me also that they do it down there as well, although I haven't been down there, but that's what I've heard anyway.
Yeah, the two hotbeds of UFO activity are the Lake Titicaca area and also here in the Nazca Paracas area. My wife and I actually saw one the night before last.
Oh, really? Fascinating. What did it look like?
Well, in general, what people see here are like large orbs or large balls of light. They don't see metallic craft too much.
Okay.
So this was an orange pulsing sphere that was, I would guess, probably about 5 miles away, that had a red pulsing center. At first, of course, I thought it was a helicopter. But it was flying very low, and it was coming towards us. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, it stopped, and it started going backwards at a higher speed, and then started pulsing above the 2 o'clock position, and then disappeared. And we watched it for about 5 minutes, and it had to have been it couldn't have been some kind of governmental black project. This is a phenomenon that is way beyond our comprehension of technology. So that's the latest encounter we had, and I'm just glad my wife was standing next to me, because that way we could converse back and forth as we were observing the phenomena.
I got a message from you. I got a couple messages for you, Brian, and one of them is that what you should have said is, Scotty, beam me up. There's very little intelligent life on this planet. No, I just kidding. Course, but that's amazing. Have you seen UFOs around Paracas or other parts of Peru?
Yeah, actually, I think it was about 2 years ago. We saw 12 golden yellow balls of light that were flying in formation south of us, so heading towards Nazca, and they were moving in a coordinated activity, but not. More like things on a petri dish. There was no real pattern to them.
Okay.
But we watched that for about 10 minutes until they disappeared. And then much more recently, I was on the third floor of the house looking up at the sky at Orion, and a golden yellow ball went past me going from south to north, completely silent. It looked like a glass or plastic ball with a coherent light in the middle of it. Until the night before last, that was my most recent observation. We've also seen at Lake Titicaca, at two sacred sites, what appeared to be UFOs very high up in the sky.
Wow, amazing, amazing. I know that when I was at Nazca Lines a couple of weeks ago, I asked one of the pilots there, because I went on a tour of the Nazca Lines by plane. I asked one of the pilots whether he had seen UFOs, and he said he had, actually, and sometimes he'll see reticular clouds, which are like these circular clouds, appear out of nowhere. And I see the same kind of clouds, by the way, up at Mount Shasta in Northern California, because there, my friends from the Hollow Earth say that they hide their spacecraft that way by covering them in these cloud formations above the mountain. I think there's probably been UFO activity and extraterrestrial influence in Peru and by extension all over the planet for tens of thousands of years. But you just kind of have to look for it.
Yeah, well, I agree. Almost everyone I know here has seen UFOs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's very common. And again, it's rarely metallic. It's usually balls of light, but not little balls, like reasonably large things. And you see in a lot of the art and artifacts of the different cultures here, mm-hmm. Depictions of life forms, which, of course, academics would say are mythical. But
right.
There's a great connection with, shall we say, off-world visitors and ancient cultures in Peru that spans back as far as we can possibly fathom.
Now, going back, one thing I want to ask you about you mentioned that there was genocide, that about 500 AD, according to my notes, that there was a Nazca genocide of Paracas. Is that right? Paracas culture, would that be elongated people where they actually killed them all off? Is that what, if I'm not?
Well, actually, it's more like 100 AD. Most academics believe that the Nazca simply moved in and blended with the Paracas. But when you look at the art, Paracas art is always playful and colorful. You'll see lots of depictions of cats with almost like Cheshire cat smiles, mm-hmm. People smiling. Uh-huh. And then when you move into the Nazca culture, you get decapitated heads with blood flowing out.
Oh, my goodness.
Also, we do know that the climate change began here, uh-huh. as a result of an excessive El Nino about 100 BC. The Paracas were masters at desert agriculture, and the Nazca weren't as much.
I see.
So what happened was, I believe, is that the Nazca moved in from the north and tried to eradicate the royal Paracas culture. Some of them escaped and I think went to Cusco to become part of the seed of the later Inca. Mm-hmm. And then the Nazca took over, and the Nazca were not great farmers because they basically defoliated what was very much like African savanna.
Oh, wow.
And by 600 AD, as the result of increased climate changing and their decimation of the soil, those that survived had to move somewhere. So they moved into the highlands of Peru and amalgamated with other cultures. And that was the end of the Nazca.
Here's a theory I'd like to throw out to you, Brian, and I'd love your comment on it because of all your experience and your research into the area there. If indeed there was an extraterrestrial civilization that came to Peru back, let's say, 500 BC, and they created these hybrid elongated head individuals who were half human and half something else. And then these indigenous Nazca people come in from the north about 100 AD, maybe 500 AD, and they come in and kill off these people because they looked at them as a threat. Some escaped and formed the Inca later. But do you think that could have been one of the reasons why that they had this genocide, because they viewed them as a threat or they weren't human, fully human?
Well, from what little we know, and again, academics know very little about this culture, I'm very sad to say, mm-hmm. because if you look up Paracas culture on the internet, you're not going to find too much, which mm-hmm. is very sad. Mm-hmm. That's why I've taken on the culture, because they fascinate me. I honestly think their spirits are guiding me,
right.
because they want to be remembered. They want to be known for who they truly were. So mm-hmm. far, I have seen no object of all the artifacts I've seen that you could definitively call a weapon. So I think they were a very peaceful society,
uh-huh.
and I, I think the Nazca were very much more warlike people, so
right.
it would have been easy for them to take over and wipe out the culture, just in the same way that the Spanish were able to take out the Inca through deceit and sheer force.
Well, the peacefulness of the Paracas culture makes sense, because if they did in fact provide the seed for the later development of the Inca culture, the Incas were of course, they went out and tried to gain territory throughout Peru and other parts of South America, but they weren't, I don't think from what you've said in your book says that they weren't really a violent nation. And maybe the Paracas, the escaping people from Paracas, went north and they provided the seed, like you said, for the peaceful Inca culture.
Well, I think so. I believe that the Inca have a very complex ancestry. Most academics think that they simply came from Lake Titicaca, but I've spoken to people who are of the royal Inca bloodline, and they say we're a very complicated mix,
right,
of ancient peoples. And they also say they agree with me, and the experts that I know, the native experts I know who live in Cusco,
right,
laugh at the idea that nobody was living in Cusco before the Inca. They say this place is thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years old. They also speak of interactions with beings or people from different planets, possible mm-hmm. seeding or hybridization mm-hmm. from possibly Sirius and the Pleiades, etc. And that's a reason why we're conducting DNA testing of the ancient Paracas, is because academics have done zero DNA testing of who these people were.
Right.
And that's how we're going to find out, at least to some degree, who these ancient people were and where they came from, because it's unlikely that they simply developed on the coast of Peru. They had to have come from somewhere else, because
right.
they were far too complex a civilization so fast.
Right, right, exactly. One of the things that you write about in your book, you have a picture of what's called, I hope I pronounce this right, Mano Capac and Mamo, it's spelled O-C-I-L-O, Mama Osio. They were the founders, actually, of the Incas who came from Lake Titicaca. And you've got a picture of them in your book, but one of the things that comes to my mind, if in fact Lake Titicaca is a portal to the Hollow Earth, and the civilization, one of the civilizations in the Hollow Earth is an ancient Lemurian race that escaped the destruction of Atlantis about 12,500 years ago, if in fact they were from Lemuria coming out, then that would make sense, because they'd be bringing a lot of technology and advanced benevolent ideas and spiritual concepts out with them. And perhaps under the influence as well of Sirius and the Pleiades and other star people, that's how the Incas actually started out. But it would make sense if in fact there's a portal to the Hollow Earth at Lake Titicaca.
Well, the most common statement is the Inca rose from Lake Titicaca.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So you could infer many things from that. And
right.
Again, it's very unlikely that the Inca bloodline is simply from native people from Lake Titicaca,
right?
Because their spiritual, economic, and social concepts were so incredibly advanced,
right?
It was a very, you know, people say, oh, was it a socialist society? It's like, no, it was it wasn't capitalistic, it wasn't socialistic, it was a humanistic society, which is very foreign to the 21st century,
right? And very foreign as well to the Spanish royalty who came into Peru, who were bent on extraction of gold and silver, resources, conquering in a violent way. One of the things, I'm also intact with the Galactic Alliance, which is a benevolent alliance of 450 million planets, or approximately 7 trillion entities in this one-third part of the Milky Way galaxy. And they say the royalty, including the Spanish royalty, were actually descended from negative reptilian influences about 12 to 15,000 years ago, where the reptilians came in and created a hybrid human-reptilian strain, and that constituted the royalty. And among reptilian society, which is very negatively based, they are all resource-driven. And so it would make sense if the Spanish royalty were focused in on resources, on extracting as much gold and silver and resources out of Peru as possible and throughout Mexico and South and Central and Latin America. And so it kind of makes sense. But I think you're right, too, Brian, in the sense that the history is very complicated. You have all these influences there. And it takes some time to sort everything out because we don't have the full picture, certainly.
No, and that's one of the reasons why I'm living in Peru is my ongoing fascination with the Inca culture and the Paracas culture and the Nazca as well. But the more time I spend here, the more I'm able to visit ancient sites and visit local experts who tend to be native. Mm-hmm. My two teachers at the moment are both native people of the Cusco area. And because I've been around native people since I was a child, I know how to approach them in a respectful manner. Sure. And want to learn as if I'm a little child. And more they're opening up and telling me things that are not in any history books whatsoever.
Right, right, right. Well, you're doing wonderful work. And there was one of the shaman in Cusco recently told me a Hopi Indian prophecy. And he said that I've written it down. Actually, I've got it in a little book here. If I remember correctly, he said that when the eagle and the condor join, there will be peace on the planet, and we will ascend. Humanity will ascend. The eagle meaning the United States and North America, and the condor meaning Peru and South America. And I thought that was such a very kind of touching saying he told me about recently when I was in Cusco.
Yeah, that's an ongoing process. It's been going on since I think about 1992.
Okay.
And it is ongoing. It's not, of course, in the public eye because this is something that Native people are doing with each other. But a lot of Native people from Peru are being invited to things like powwows and other celebrations in North America. Right. Native American wisdom keepers are either being brought down or invited to or simply are coming to the Cusco area because the Native resonance is rising. The interesting thing is that the Inca had a time period or cycle of 500 years. So 1492 mm-hmm. was the beginning of the destruction,
right.
The entrance into the dark period.
Okay.
And so 1992 was the beginning of light. So that's why more and more people of a spiritual nature are visiting Cusco and the area because anyone of any sensitivity has a tendency to come, be awe-inspired, heart-lifted, go home, and then always come back again many times. Whereas the average tourist is like, I want to see Machu Picchu. I want to take my picture
right.
there.
Right.
Then I want to go home. But
right.
it's people of true integrity, heart, powerful spirit that are drawn to Peru, especially at this time, because the energy of Cusco and the Inca is rising again.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. And the planet's changing and things are rapidly moving very, very fast. Well, Brian, we have about 2 minutes left, a minute and a half left now, and I want to give you the rest of the time to please wrap up your wonderful interview today.
Oh, well, mainly I want to thank you and your listeners, and I hope we can hook up again and talk more. There are many other subjects we can talk about, such as ancient Egypt, lost ancient high technology I found in many places of the planet. More on Easter Island, if you want, and
much more on
Polynesia, because I learned a lot about Mu when I was living in Hawaii and also in New Zealand and Tahiti and places like that. If people are interested in my work, more than 90% of my information is free, and it's located on my website, hiddenincatours.com. I basically have a full-time webmaster who lives in India. He's an American, but he's also the webmaster for the Dalai Lama. So he's a wonderful man, and you'll find 930 of my videos, lots of other information, and access to my books, which of course you do have to pay for, but almost most of my work is free because it's important at this time that the information get out to anyone who wants to listen to it.
I couldn't agree with you more. Brian, have a beautiful, wonderful day in Pecaris, and please say hello to my friends Roberto and Maria at the Hotel Copa Pelli. And thank you so much again for coming on my show today. Thank you so much, Brian.